Well, last Sunday, in the first part of this message, we had left off having looked at and defined the four divine institutions given by God for the successful functioning of human society. And we did that because we needed to do that in order to examine when and why our nation began its decline. And based on things pertaining to the forming of our Constitution, for the next 150 years, our nation goes on to become the greatest nation on earth, based solely upon the degree of absolute truth residing in those four divine institutions established by God. Now understand that the founding fathers probably never verbalized this concept of four divine institutions. These just happen to be a convenient way for us to categorize a logical general outline of the absolute truths which the founding fathers recognized as the laws of nature established by God. Now, does all this imply that our nation was immune to evil and wrongdoing? Obviously not. Of course not. There has always been a degree of lawlessness and evil. People still murdered one another. There has always been adultery and homosexuality going on in our society. People still made poor choices in life. Yes, people who called themselves Christians still made poor choices in life, just as I or anyone else may do. The injustices of no less than human slavery contributed to the Civil War and tore the nation apart. Injustices, by the way, for which this nation is still seeing the consequences even to this day. Now, I'm going to touch on something here, which I'll elaborate on further when we look at those forces of evil which we see going on the world stage, and that is this issue of reaping what you sow, or the consequences of your choices. The consequences of using your free will to make choices in life which run contrary to the laws of nature established by God. The principle is found in Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 through 9, and is based on what every farmer who has ever lived knows to be true, the laws of the harvest. And that is, you reap what you sow. There are consequences for what you do. Not only do you reap what you sow, but the laws of the harvest demonstrate that you will reap more than you sow, and that you are not going to reap until sometime after you do the sowing. Now, before anyone jumps to any conclusions here about what I'm implying, I want to make it perfectly clear what I am not saying. I am not implying that God is judging anything or anybody today, because he's not. But what I am saying is that what you see today are the natural consequences of the failure of sound Bible doctrine, the failure of those laws of nature, the failure of those absolute truths being demonstrated in any or all of the four divine institutions given by God. Let me say what I said previously. Those four divine institutions are designed for the optimal functioning and perpetuation and success of human society. Anything which negatively influences any of those institutions in any way can only have a negative effect within that institution and therefore within the society as a whole. And within each individual institution, optimal function and success is dependent directly upon the amount of absolute truth which is found and which is operational within that institution. You are not seeing the judgment of God anywhere in this world today. God will be doing plenty of judging down the road in association with the second coming of Jesus Christ, but that is not what you are seeing today. What you are seeing today at every level of society are the natural consequences associated with the abandoning of God's truth within whatever institution you might be looking at. So our nation, as great as it was was never a perfect nation, by any means. But for 150 years, our nation had something that no other nation had ever had. Based on God-given principles, those laws of nature, there was within our nation an underlying attitude which was very aptly described by theologian Francis A. Schaeffer as the Christian consensus. The Christian consensus. Now, what does that mean? The Christian consensus began with the understanding that there is a creator God, and that when you understand that God does exist, you will also understand that you are going to be accountable to that God according to his absolute standards of truth. What that is the first divine institution established by God for the successful functioning of human society, human volition. The free will which every person has to make choices in life based on God's standards of absolute truth. And that underlying Christian consensus prevailed in this country in the majority of its citizens, even in people with absolutely no connection to any Christian church or religion whatsoever. That underlying consensus prevailed in this country for 150 years. But then, in the early 1900s, there began to emerge certain other insidious philosophies, philosophies which stood in opposition to the absolute truths found in the Bible, those absolute truths which had been so instrumental in establishing that Christian consensus which had so permeated the culture in America for 150 years. Those opposing philosophies were known as relativism, or legal positivism, or sometimes referred to as pragmatism. These philosophies began to be insidiously introduced into the thinking of leading educators of the day and into the thinking of the judicial branch of our government. The basic tenet of this philosophy of relativism is the idea that there is no such thing as absolute truth because human society is in a constant state of change, so that truth may not be what it had been in the past. And that truth is really whatever works for you in any given situation. Does that sound a little familiar? Talk about a recipe for chaos and disorder. There you have it. And this is where our nation is today. The Encyclopedia of Religion, published by Macmillan in 1987, describes and defines relativism in the following manner. I'll quote, "Views are to be evaluated relative to the societies in which they appear and are not to be judged true or false, good or bad, based on some overall criterion, but are to be assessed in the context in which they occur. Thus, what is right or good or true to one person or group may not be considered so by others. There are no absolute standards. Man is the measure of all things, and each man could be his own measure." End of the quote. Now, most of our listeners out there probably would not appreciate how that these are the same philosophies and attitudes which eventually caused the demise of God's chosen nation, Israel, and which resulted in their being taken into Assyrian and Babylonian captivities in 720 and 586 BC. The result of that type of convoluted thinking, which resulted in the total demise of Israel, is very succinctly summarized in the Bible in Judges chapter 21, verse 25, which states that how in those days every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And that was the beginning of the end for the nation Israel. Well, these insidious and destructive philosophies began to be introduced into the thinking of educators and judges through the efforts of primarily three American philosophers. Those three men were Charles S. Peirce, William James, and a man whose name you might be a little more familiar with, John Dewey. of the Dewey Decimal System. In John Dewey's book, The Public Law and Its Problems, 1927, John Dewey wrote the following, and I'll quote, "The belief in political fixity of the sanctity of some form of state, consecrated by the efforts of our fathers and hallowed by tradition, is one of the stumbling blocks in the way of orderly and directed change." End of the quote. In other words, the Constitution, which our founding fathers had put together, has now become a stumbling block to us and is holding us back from improving as a society, as a nation. And by the 1940s, these God-rejecting, Bible-rejecting philosophies began to be reflected in certain Supreme Court decisions. By the 1970s, this philosophy of relativism had crept its way into the public school systems of America under the name of situational ethics or values clarification, where students were exposed to the idea that there is no such thing as absolute truth and that what was right was determined only by circumstances. Now, many of our listeners might remember that stuff. I went to elementary school in the late 50s and the early 60s. I remember my teachers talking about that kind of stuff. At the time, I couldn't understand the point of it all. Why were they bringing things like this into the classroom? Didn't seem to fit. I also remember that the teachers who introduced these things to us really didn't seem to have their heart in what they were teaching. The whole thing was quite confusing to me at the time, but it's pretty clear now what was going on then. And this is where problems really began to escalate, folks. The spirit of the God of this world was successfully getting into the minds of our children and the American people unlike any time before, and that Christian consensus, so aptly described by Francis A. Schaeffer, began to gradually erode away. Our young people lost a sense of purpose and became drawn into a world of drugs and all manner of mind-altering substances, looking for something they knew they didn't have anymore. Materialism took hold of families, creating a perceived need to be a two-income family now, in most cases, solely for the sake of materialism and material gain. And the incredibly important and irreplaceable, absolutely irreplaceable role of the mother in the home for the benefit of the children began to be held in less and less esteem. Children in the government school systems began to lose all sense of what was right and what is wrong unless they were fortunate enough to have God-fearing parents who were subverting the teaching and philosophies that their children were being exposed to in the schools. Juvenile delinquency was now on the rise. Divorce rates began to escalate. All of this contributing to the deterioration and destruction of those first three divine institutions: the ability to make good decisions in life, marriage relationships, and the family. This is all taking place as that philosophy of relativism is making its way into the judicial courts of the land and becomes known as legal positivism. Legal positivism, based on five major tenets. Those five major tenets are, number one, there are no objective God-given standards of law, or if there are, they are irrelevant to the modern legal system. Number two, since God is not the author of law, the author of law must be man. It is law simply because the highest human authority, the state, has said it is law and is able to back it up. Number three, since man and society is evolving, law must evolve as well. Number four, judges through their decisions guide the evolution of law. And number five, to study law, get to the original sources of law, the decision of judges. Hence, most law schools today use the case law method of teaching law. So then, any error which creeps into the legal system is going to compound and proliferate upon itself into further error as society moves further and further away from absolute truth, those laws of nature established by God for the successful functioning of human society. There should be no problem in seeing how that the foundations of the Christian consensus, so prevalent within the nation since the establishing of the Constitution, were being completely dismantled. And thus it should be no problem seeing why there is so much confusion today over what is and what is not constitutional, what is and what is not right and wrong. Because when you look at everything going on today, the abandonment of absolute truth, political correctness, the redefining of tolerance and of marriage, and the mandating of atheistic philosophies of evolution in the school systems, you have nothing but chaos and confusion. And the young people in America today don't even know that it was ever any other way. All the air just becomes slowly embedded into the warp and woof of their thinking and becomes the norm of the day. I know exactly what many of our listeners are saying right now. You think the Bible and Christianity are the answer for everything. Many of our listeners are undoubtedly saying, I know scores of Christians, and they're no different than anyone else in the world. In fact, some of them are even worse people than the atheists I know, people who never even set foot in a church. Well, my response to that would be that the overwhelming majority of those who claim to be Christians today are not Christians at all. Someone is not a Christian, folks, a true Christian, because they attend a so-called Christian church. It's no different than the way I described Christians within a nation as opposed to a Christian nation in part one of this teaching, when we looked at those issues in association with the founding fathers and our Constitution. Someone's not a Christian just because they attend a so-called Christian church. I'm sure it would surprise many of our listeners out there that there are so-called Christian churches which do not contain a single Christian. And it will certainly surprise many of our listeners out there to learn that you can walk into countless numbers of so-called Christian churches in this nation where its leaders, the pastors, the priests, or whatever title they may go by, are not Christians either. Church leaders teaching false information, teaching false doctrines and preaching false gospels which have no power to make anyone a Christian today, much less change people's lives and behavior. In fact, that is the norm today rather than the exception. The church leaders I'm talking about are described and warned against in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 3 and 4, and verses 13, 14, and 15. Where these church leaders are revealed for who they really are, and where their teaching is revealed for what it really is, and whose spirit is actually the driving force behind it all. Some of these church leaders do this by obvious intent and design. All you have to do is turn on Christian radio and TV for a while, motivated by greed and power, no different than the spirit of this world, which drives most of our political leaders. But the fact is that most of them, do it simply out of ignorance of what the Bible actually teaches, not even understanding what they're actually doing, leaving them totally vulnerable to the spirit of the God of this world. Unable to accurately teach what the Bible really teaches, or about how to become saved and become a true Christian, or teaching things that really, really sound good, teaching things that people really want to hear today, just as the Apostle Paul warned would be the case in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, teaching all kinds of really feel-good stuff, but which has no power to enable a person to become saved and to become a true Christian. You probably won't find one church in 100, maybe one church in 500, that would be able to explain to you how the things found in the Bible apply to everything going on in our cities and in our nation today and in the world today, the way you're hearing it presented to you right now. And you haven't heard anything yet, folks, because I haven't even started explaining why we see what we see going on the world stage. The average church today either wants to be an entertainment center or some place that can provide something for everyone, from recycling to fitness programs, completely abandoning the mission of the true church. The true church, which is supposed to exist for one reason and one reason only, one mission. That mission is described in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15, as being the pillar and ground of the truth for human society. Preserving and presenting those unchanging laws of nature, which our founding fathers referred to in the preamble to the Declaration of Independence and incorporated into our Constitution, and for the preparation and perfecting of its members to be able to go out into their own spheres of influence, doing the work of the ministry, as described in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 through 16. What is that ministry? Every true Christian has been appointed by God to be a literal ambassador for Christ. As described in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 17 through 21. An ambassador, folks, is the official representative and spokesperson for someone else. The role of a true Christian is to speak for Christ in his absence, to maintain a constant proclamation to this world of the veracity and the absolute truths presented in the Word of God, and to equip its members to present to the world the message of what Christ has done to save every one of us from our own personal sin problem. And the extent, listen to me, and the extent to which I fall short of your expectations or anyone else's expectations of me as a true Christian is really only the result of the extent to which I allow my own self-will and my own self-interests to take precedent over what I should be doing based on the gratitude and love that I should have for Jesus Christ because of what he has done for me. That is the struggle, by the way, which is true for every true Christian. What's it going to be? My will or what Christ would have me do? You see, folks, Christ was our example. The night before he was tortured and crucified, he prayed to his Father three times that if there was any other way to provide the solution which mankind needed for its sin and evil, that it could be found. But there wasn't any other way. And Christ set his mind and said, "Nevertheless, not my will be done, but thine." You can read about that account in Matthew chapter 26, verses 36 through 44. That is the mindset which God would have every true Christian demonstrate. And that is also explained to us in Philippians chapter 2, verses 2 through 13. Let me repeat once again. The extent to which I fall short of your expectations or anyone else's expectations of me as a true Christian is not God's fault, and it's not the Bible's fault. It is the result of the extent to which I allow my own self-will and my own self-interest to take precedence over what I should be doing based on the gratitude and the love which I should have for Jesus Christ because of what he has done for me. Now, I want to get into something that is extremely important here, because now we're getting into the solutions for some of these battlegrounds and these problems which we see in society today. The degree to which a true Christian understands everything that the future has in store for them as a result of becoming a Christian, understanding their literal ambassadorship for the Lord, and the message which we have been entrusted with by the Lord, and the manner in which the Lord has equipped us to be able to do this, the degree to which a true Christian understands and appreciates these things is the degree to which that Christian is able to transform his or her former self from whatever they were or thought they were or thought they wanted to be into what God would have them be. You understanding what I'm getting at here? In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, the Apostle Paul is reminding the Corinthian converts there about many of the things which they had been involved in before they got saved and became true Christians. That list contains all manner of activities which are an abomination in the eyes of God, activities that always have been and always will be an abomination in the eyes of God. Homosexuality and other alternate lifestyles are in that list. And you know what God, through Paul, says about all that? He says, "And such were some of you." You see, some of those Christians, those Corinthians, did get saved through the gospel of salvation, which had been entrusted to Paul and to us today. And these people who got saved came to understand the reality of the new identity which they now had. A fully satisfying identity and purpose. An identity which was capable of overriding any previous identity they may have thought they had or wanted to have, but which was clearly contrary to the will of God for their lives. Are you understanding what I'm saying here? Mr. Jenner, if you may happen to hear this message someday, unlike those gang members in Chicago who feel like their life isn't worth anything, the life of these Corinthians could now have a purpose. Now, those whose former life was controlled by sexual behaviors contrary to the will of God had a new capacity, motivated by love and gratitude for what Jesus Christ had done for them, a new capacity to abandon their former willful desires and replace those desires with the desire to demonstrate a lifestyle consistent with what God would have them be, out of love and out of gratitude. So the solution for these types of social abnormalities is never going to be through the frantic political efforts of the religious right. True change just doesn't happen that way. And the abandoning of those first three God-given divine institutions for the successful functioning of human society has now progressed way too far in the wrong direction among the general populace in America to be able to anticipate a swing back towards truth and sanity. Momentum is all in the direction of continual deterioration and change in our nation. The efforts of Christian-based organizations like J. Sekulow's American Center for Law and Justice and similar legal organizations like that may continue to hold back, to some degree, the tide of these social evils like abortion and and the attempts to suppress free Bible-based speech, but the reality is that those efforts are now like a bucket brigade on the Titanic. The only realistic goal at this point for Bible-believing Christians is to be able to reach as many people as possible within their own personal spheres of influence in an attempt to influence as many people as possible with real truth, so as to be able to equip and prepare their families for the future decline which is inevitable. And of course, hopefully there may be some others out there who might be listening to this message and messages like this and decide to climb on board as well. However, make no mistake about it, folks, the price for embracing and preaching truth will soon be very, very high. As I said earlier in this message, we are living in the day when evil is proclaimed as good, and good is evil. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20. So where will all this end up? And is there an answer for all this evil in our nation? Well, if you've been picking up on the things which I've been trying to say here, you should understand at this point that there is certainly an answer for the individual, any individual. Any individual has the potential to comprehend real truth, change their thinking, and respond in a way which will ensure that their ultimate personal future and eternal destiny can be as successful as any individual's future could possibly be, and the future of their spouse, and of their family, if they should happen to have one, despite whatever persecutions may come down the road, in spite of however deplorable the state of our nation may become, Christians within a nation, as we talked about in the first part of this message. Unfortunately, that future will undoubtedly be lived out in the context of a nation which will be experiencing steady decline and problems and animosity towards truth. And those individuals who choose to hold fast to truth will undoubtedly have to be willing to stand up against the inevitable persecution which is sure to come as a result of standing for truth. All you need to understand is what Christ told his disciples: if the world hates me, it's sure going to hate you too. John chapter 15, verses 18 and 19. The other choice is you could become a closet Christian and remain relatively safe, but let me remind you that that was the situation in Nazi Germany before the war. But our nation, as a nation, has most likely reached a point of no return. Well, with that said, it's now time to move on to the evils which abound on the world stage. As I said previously, I began putting this message together on December 6, 2015, 4 days after what was then the most recent terrorist attack on a group of Americans in San Bernardino, California, killing 14 people and wounding 17. That attack in San Bernardino took place just 19 days following the ISIS attack at several sites in Paris, France, on November 13th, killing 130 people and wounding hundreds of others. And that attack in Paris, France, was just a little less than 5 weeks after the bombing of a Russian passenger plane traveling from Egypt to St. Petersburg, Russia, killing all 224 people on board on October 31st. Later, to be determined that the bomb which took down that Russian airliner was also the work of terrorists, most likely ISIS-related. And of course, the most recent terrorist attack occurred just a couple of weeks ago in Brussels, Belgium, on March 22nd, killing 34 and wounding 212. Those events and events like that raised the fear of air travel to new levels for many people and heightened the efforts of government surveillance, internet monitoring, and intelligence gathering in virtually every country on the globe as it became increasingly obvious that the forces of evil against civilized members of the human community could strike anyone, anywhere, and at any time. Unrest in the Middle East has reached unprecedented levels as most of the countries surrounding the nation Israel remain intent upon wiping Israel off the face of the earth. And the question on everyone's mind is, what is going on in the world today? And where will all this end up? And is there an answer for all this evil? And I'm sorry to say that the evil which we see going on the world stage has no less dismal future than what I proposed for America. And once again, although there will be no solution for these problems by the political leaders of our day, there certainly is an explanation. And if for no other reason than the mere existence of the nation Israel and the problems associated in the Middle East centering around the nation Israel, if for no other reason than that alone should be enough to get people's attention and to reason that maybe we just ought to take a look at what the Bible has to say about all this, because it has a whole lot to say about this. And just as it was necessary to look at the history of our country in order to understand why we are steadily deteriorating as a nation, so is it necessary to look at the history of the nation Israel in order to understand the evils we see on the world stage today. And that history begins in Genesis chapter 12. In Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 7, God calls a man by the name of Abraham out of his pagan, idolatrous homeland and gives him a number of tremendous promises. Two of those promises are what we want to specifically take note of and understand today. The first promise is given in verse 2 and has to do with Abraham's descendants. God promised Abraham that he and his descendants would become a great nation. That nation, of course, was going to be the nation of Israel. Israel was to be God's special and chosen nation, and Abraham was to be the father of that nation. But if you've been paying any attention at all to world events these days, you might recognize that there is another group of people who claim Abraham as their father. And those are the people of Islam. Now just keep that in the back of your mind for right now. The second promise given to Abraham that needs to be understood is found in verse 7 of chapter 12, where God promises Abraham and his descendants that he will give them a particular area of land. It's going to be theirs forever. In Genesis 15, verse 18, and in various other passages in the Scripture, God reveals the precise location of that land. It will extend from the Nile River in Egypt to the Euphrates River on the west. It is a huge area of the Middle East, which is commonly referred to as the Fertile Crescent or the land of Palestine. And it extends all the way up into land of Syria, the country of Syria today. Abraham's descendants, the nation Israel, and the land. These are the two issues which are the driving forces having to do with the evil which we see going on the world stage today. So God calls out this man Abraham to be the father of the nation Israel, and God begins dealing with Abraham to make all that happen. But something very interesting and something very unfortunate happens in the life of Abraham during his relationship with God. By the time you get to Genesis chapter 15, Abraham begins to wonder how all of this can come to be, since he has no descendants, none, no children. And Sarah, his wife, is rapidly aging and becoming beyond the age of childbearing years. But God assures Abraham at that time that he and his wife, Sarah, will most certainly produce descendants, exactly in accordance with the promises of God. And it becomes a matter of faith on the part of Abraham to believe that God will do this. More time goes by, and Abraham and Sarah continue to remain childless. And Sarah has now progressed well beyond the childbearing years. But Sarah has this personal servant, a maid. Her name is Hagar. And Sarah convinces Abraham that perhaps they might be able to help God along here if by chance Abraham could possibly produce a son by way of Hagar. Now, I want to say that this is actually was a common practice of the day, where if the man of the family had the misfortune of remaining childless with his natural wife, it was quite commonplace to take a concubine in order to carry on the lineage. And although this was commonplace in that day to have children by more than one woman for this purpose, it was not something which God approved of, and especially in Abraham's situation. This was not the way God had planned for Abraham to have the son of promise. Abraham was supposed to have faith that God would do exactly what he said he would do without any help from anyone else. And this decision between Abraham and Sarah to do what Sarah had proposed becomes a huge, huge mistake in the life of Abraham, because Abraham's childless situation was merely a test of faith. God didn't need anyone's help to accomplish what he said he was going to accomplish. And this whole situation with Abraham and his mistake brings up another issue which is demonstrated repeatedly in the Bible. When the lives of the great men of the Bible, the heroes of the Bible, God's people, when their lives are written about in the Bible, there is never any attempt to pass over or sugarcoat or rationalize the shortcomings and the sins of those individuals. And sin always complicates life. And sin always has its consequences. You will reap what you sow. So Abraham and Sarah go through with this plan in an attempt to help God out. And Hagar does become pregnant. And Hagar does produce a son for Abraham. His name is Ishmael. The problem with this is that this was not according to God's plan. And it isn't very long until the whole situation blows up and begins to reap a harvest according to that which has been sown. Great animosity and great hostility now develops between Hagar and Sarah after Hagar successfully bears a son for Abraham. Hagar now perceives herself as a recipient of the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant and the promises which God had made to the son of promise. And this is the beginning of the problems we see on the world stage today. According to the promise of God, Sarah does then go on to miraculously produce a son for Abraham. His name is going to be Isaac. Isaac. And God had made it perfectly clear to Abraham in Genesis chapter 17, verses 19 through 21, even before Isaac was born, that it was going to be through Isaac, the son of promise, which God had promised to Abraham, that it would be through Isaac who all the promises of God for the nation Israel would come to be, and not through Ishmael. And that is why you will find the God of the Bible repeatedly, at least 17 times, referring to himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob, who would go on to become the son of Isaac. Not the God of Abraham and Ishmael, but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In Genesis chapter 21, verses 1 through 3, Isaac, that son of promise, is finally born to Abraham and Sarah. And Genesis chapter 21, verse 8, quickly fast forwards us to the point in Isaac's life where Isaac is now a young lad, and Ishmael is now 13 years old. And what we see in the next verse is a continuation of that same animosity and hostility which first developed between Hagar and Sarah, now taking place between Ishmael and Isaac. That hostility and that animosity escalated to the point where God instructed Abraham to cast out Hagar and Ishmael from out of his household. They have to go. They had no place in God's promises given to Abraham regarding the descendants or the land which Abraham's descendants are destined to inherit forever, because Isaac was to be the son of promise, not Ishmael. But that is by no means the end of the story, folks, because God had made some very interesting predictions to Hagar regarding Ishmael and his future. Abraham's mistake in fathering Ishmael was not going to be without its consequences. Abraham was going to reap problems from what he had sown. And just as the law of the harvest demonstrates repeatedly, Abraham and his descendants were going to reap a lot more than what was sown, and that reaping was going to take place much later than when those seeds had been sown. Back in Genesis chapter 16, verses 7 through 12, God had told Hagar that this son of hers, Ishmael, even though he was not the son of promise, that Ishmael was also going to be the progenitor or the father of a multitude of people as well. And God went on to describe the nature of those people, how the world was going to view those descendants of Ishmael. And I want to quote for you, word for word, exactly what God had predicted about these descendants of Ishmael in Genesis chapter 16, verse 12, where it says, "And he," that is the descendants of Ishmael, "will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand will be against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of his brethren." That description fit anybody you hear about today? Ishmael's brethren are the descendants of Isaac. Ishmael's brethren are the nation Israel. Is any of this beginning to sound a little contemporary? Those descendants of Ishmael became the Bedouin tribes of the deserts all around the Middle East down through the centuries. They are the Arab Muslim nations and people of the Middle East. People who also call themselves sons of Abraham. And they are. But their problem is that they are not the sons of promise through Isaac. They are the sons of Ishmael who had been cast out. But just as God predicted, they are dwelling in the presence of the sons of Isaac, in the presence of the nation Israel. Now, as anyone who is familiar with the history of the nation Israel knows, because of their failure to be the nation which God had intended for them to be, and because they basically forsook the Lord their God, part of the nation was taken into captivity by the Assyrians in 720 BC, and the remainder of the nation was taken into Babylonian captivity in 586 BC. And for all intents and purposes, the history of the nation Israel as a nation was over. Interestingly, God had predicted that this is exactly what would happen to the nation centuries before it actually happened. It was predicted that this would be the fate of the nation through the warnings and prophecies of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 32. And now, as a result of those captivities, Jewish people, for the most part, have been dispersed and have remained dispersed among all the nations of the world. And interestingly, God had also warned Israel that the scattering and dispersion of the nation would also occur. He made that known through the prophet Moses, even back in Leviticus chapter 26. Now, some of the questions which anyone should naturally be asking at this point are these. How could it be that the author of this book, which we call the Bible, how could the author of this book have written through Moses these things pertaining to the history of Israel 4,000 years ago? How could the author of this book have known that this nation Israel, which God had chosen to be his special people, would forsake the Lord their God exactly as Moses predicted they would? How could the author of this book have known that the nation Israel would be taken into captivity by Assyria and Babylonia as a result of their forsaking the Lord, just as God had predicted through his prophets would happen, those prophets who warned the nation and its leaders for hundreds of years that these impending judgments were imminent unless they changed their ways? And you have to ask yourself, how could it be that the author of this book could know the people of this nation, Israel, would then be dispersed among all the nations of the earth, just as they are today, and just as God had predicted in Leviticus 26 would be the case as a result of those judgments? And that there would not even be a nation, Israel, until almost 6,000 years later, where you had Jews scattered all over the earth, yet with no country, no nation, until 1948, yet would once again become a nation. And yet there is the nation Israel. That defies all logic and reason. And not only that, but that Israel would not only become a nation once again, but that Israel would become a nation which would become the center, the reason, the focal point of world turmoil and hostility, just as it is predicted in the Bible and just as we see it happening today. If you're not familiar with those predictions, you should be. In chapter 12, verse 2, in the prophet Zechariah, he writes how that the day will come when Israel will literally become a cup of trembling unto all the people round about. That seems to be a pretty good metaphor to describe what appears to be happening in regards to Israel today, wouldn't you say? In verse 3 of Zechariah 12, it describes Israel as a burdensome stone for all people. Now that expression, cup of trembling, in verse 2 becomes even more interesting when you look at the Hebrew language with which that verse was originally written. That word trembling carries with it sort of a sense of one-track-minded obsession with the annihilation of the nation Israel. Folks, if you think things are tense over in the Middle East right now, you haven't seen anything yet. Tensions in the Middle East are going to continue to rise to a level that our political leaders can't even imagine. Psalm 83 in the Bible describes a confederacy of 10 nations who, even though they may have tremendous differences between one another, will nevertheless come together with one common goal. And that common goal is to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. I'll quote for you verse 4 from Psalm 83, which says of these 10 nations, they have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may no more be in remembrance. Does that sound like any of the things you hear being said over there these days? I'd like to take a few minutes now to quote for you, bring back to your memory, a few of the statements that have appeared in the media in recent years from various groups of people over there in the Middle East. Let's start with the late Osama bin Laden. You might recall that bin Laden sent a videotape to our political leaders following the attack of 9/11, in which he explained that the future security of America was in our own hands, that the United States could avoid another 9/11 if it stopped violating and threatening the security of Muslims. What was the sense in which the United States was threatening the security of Muslims. It was the fact that we were an ally of Israel, Israel's most important and powerful ally. Bin Laden, speaking in reference to the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, in which towers and buildings in Beirut were destroyed, here is a quote from Bin Laden off the tape that he sent to us. I'll quote him. "While I was looking at these destroyed towers in Lebanon, it sparked my mind that the tyrant should be punished with the same, and that we should destroy towers in America so that it, the tyrant, America, tastes what we taste and would be deterred from killing our children and women." End of the quote. You see, folks, it all boils down to that one-track-minded obsession to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, that same animosity and hostility that began all the way back with Hagar and Sarah and then progressed on through Ishmael and Isaac, and which has continued on from then until now, only to get worse. Former Iraq President Saddam Hussein made the following statement pertaining to the United States shortly after our missiles hit targets in and around Baghdad after the war in Iraq began. He said, quote, "We promise you that Iraq, its leadership and its peoples will stand up to the evil invaders and will take them to such limits that they will lose their patience in achieving their plans, which are pushed by criminal Zionism." Criminal Zionism. You see, folks, it's all about Israel. And anyone who stands with Israel is just as much hated by these people as Israel itself. And then how about Iran's leader, Ahmadinejad? This character doesn't even try to hide the fact that he wants to develop nuclear weapons for the purpose of blowing Israel off the face of the earth. And we're readily willing to make treaties with him. And the tensions in the Middle East continue to rise, don't they? Did you know that 10-nation confederacy in Psalm 83, which will one day join together and rise up against Israel, are all named in Psalm 83? Obviously, the names which are listed in the Psalm 83, are not identical to the names that those countries have today, but the national heritage of the people who are named in that psalm are the same. Who are they? Well, verse 6 speaks of the Ishmaelites. Who are the Ishmaelites? Well, they're the descendants of Ishmael. Ishmael's descendants settled in the area east of Egypt, south of Israel, in that region which today is predominantly Saudi Arabia. Verse 6 also speaks to the Hagarines. Who are they? Remember Hagar, Ishmael's mother? They're the descendants of Hagar. Hagar went on to bear additional sons who settled in a different location than the descendants of Ishmael. They settled in that area which today would be the northwestern part of present-day Jordan. That's where they are. Verse 6 also speaks of Moab and Edom. Edom today would be the southernmost part of present-day Jordan, up to about the southern extent of the Dead Sea. Moab today is roughly the central one-third of present-day Jordan. In verse 7, you have Ammon, which is in the heart of the area around present-day Amman, Jordan. Verse 7 also speaks of Gebel, an area located 25 miles north of Beirut, Lebanon, where those towers were destroyed that Bin Laden referred to. Verse 7 also speaks of Amalek, the Philistines, and the inhabitants of Tyre. These are all regions along the Mediterranean coast and southwest of the Dead Sea towards Egypt, up in the Gaza area. And finally, verse 8 speaks of Assur. Assur is Assyria, or Syria, an area which today would include present-day Syria, Iraq, Turkey, and Iran. Now, I hope you can see what kind of a geographical picture this is painting. All these nations completely surround, basically landlocking, Israel, and are located in that land which God had promised to Abraham and his descendants through Isaac, not Ishmael. And tensions in the Middle East continue to rise as these Arab Muslim nations and the descendants of Ishmael continue to insist that they are the rightful people of the land which God had promised to Abraham's descendants. Well, as I said before, if for no other reason than the mere existence of the nation Israel and the problems associated in the Middle East centering around the nation Israel, if for no other reason than that, that alone should be enough to get people's attention and to make anyone reason that maybe we just ought to look and see what the Bible has to say about all this. So all that seems to paint a pretty dismal picture of the future as far as the evil we see going on the world stage today, doesn't it? But those who understand God's plans and purpose for the nation Israel understand that this is by no means the end of the story. Things are going to get worse over there, a whole lot worse, but God has every intention of making the nation Israel everything that he had designed the nation to be. And God is going to fulfill all those promises that he had made to Abraham when he called out Abraham to be the father of that great nation. All those things will come to be. They won't come to be through the fruitless efforts of various political leaders on this earth. They won't come to be through the efforts of the United Nations or any other organization like the United Nations. And they won't come to be through the efforts of the people who call themselves Israel over there today. Because something that needs to be understood to make sense of all this is that the Israel which you see there today is not really God's Israel of prophecy and promise. Not yet. They are a nation. They're in the right place, all right. They're in the heart of that area which God had promised to Abraham and to his descendants through Isaac. But they are not yet the Israel of God's promise. They won't be God's nation Israel until they recognize the mistakes they've made in the past, the poor choices they've made in the past. They rejected their Messiah at his first coming. They could have realized all those promises if they had only accepted him at his first coming. But they didn't. They rejected him. Not only that, but they murdered him. That won't happen at his second coming, folks. The Bible teaches all about the second coming of Israel's Messiah, the second coming of Christ. The Bible has been absolutely spot on, with every prophecy and every prediction pertaining to the nation Israel that we've looked at and pertaining to the coming of Christ, his first coming. And I've only brought up a handful, just a handful, of the hundreds and hundreds of other prophecies which have all come to pass. With a track record like that, folks, it would be pretty stupid to presume that those predictions which are still to come won't come. Fulfilled prophecy, by the way, is one of the main reasons why we can have complete faith and confidence in what this book says. You have to base your faith on something, folks. There's nothing more sound than what we've looked at in the Bible and fulfilled prophecy. Nothing more sound than that. No other book can touch it. And it will only be with the second coming of Christ that all this evil will finally be put down. And God's Israel will be saved from annihilation by her enemies, and all those promises to Abraham will come to be. And I'll end this message by saying to our listeners for the third time now, that if for no other reason than the existence of the nation Israel and the problems associated in the Middle East centering around the nation Israel, if for no other reason than that, that alone should be enough to get people's attention and to make anyone reason that we maybe just ought to be taking a look at the Bible to see what it has to say about all this. Because only then, will you be able to understand what is going on in the world today.